It's a matter of life. And death. It's 007.
My name's Bond. James Bond.
It's deadlier. It's livelier. It's Live and Let Die, rated PG.
Welcome to the James Bond Complex. I am Matt.
My name is Edgar.
We are doing Live and Let Die, the movie.
Say live and let die.
Yeah, so it's 1973. We're going to talk about the film. I made sure to verify if the credits said Roger Moore as Ian Fleming's James Bond in Live and Let Die or Ian Fleming's Live and Let Die. And this one says in Ian Fleming's Live and Let Die. And yeah, that's not very accurate, actually.
For many reasons we won't get into.
So I'll start with the plot.
Insomnia, sir?
Instructions.
Three MI6 agents are murdered while investigating the connection between American gangster Mr. Big and the president of San Monique, Dr. Kananga. James Bond's mission is to discover what his fellow agents had discovered. His investigation leads him from Harlem to Jamaica, back to the States in New Orleans. Thanks to the help of Solitaire, Kananga's fortune teller and consigliere, Bond discovers that Mr. Big is in fact Kananga himself, and that the dictator plans to flood the United States with free heroin in order to gain new customers that he can sell his poisons to. After confronting the drug kingpin in his lair, 007 finally blows up his adversary, avoids a final attempt on his life, and goes to bed with Solitaire as credits roll.
Yeah, for a plot that's a little bit convoluted, but as many Bond films are, in fairness. Not a whole lot of them are as simple as like Casino Royale or... License to Kill.
It's not very straightforward. There's a lot of twists and turns that are just for the sake of action for action's sake.
Yeah. I think when you've seen the franchise in its whole and all the individual installments, certainly the number of times people like you and I have seen them, after a while, you sort of come to expect that the franchise just tries to do different things depending on the decade, depending on the actor playing Bond or maybe the people writing and directing the movies. I'm not the first one to use this term. Many people have said it. This is like blaxploitation Bond.
And I don't think I've heard about them, but the Shaft, I've seen the remakes that with Samuel Jackson. I've seen the...
You got to see the original. You should check out a couple Pam Grier films as well. Coffee. Foxy Cleopatra. They're a lot of fun. So we're starting to see that the producers are, rather than being inventive, although, I mean, there's a lot of great stuff in the movie, but instead of being completely inventive and original, they are sort of riding on the coattails of a movement.
They're catching up. They're trying to catch up to the times and instead of being their own thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And as Live and Let Die is being made, they couldn't keep George Lazenby as Bond. He convinced Sean Connery to come back for one movie. That movie was a success somewhat. Mm.
Well, anytime you make money, it's a success. Artistically, it's certainly a downgrade from Majesty's.
Yeah, it's
it's time to change actors.
They don't have a choice anymore. They have to make a successful transition, and they got Roger Moore. He's not a weak point in this movie. He's not as comfortable in the role as he's going to be in later installments, but he's still fun to watch. You can see where he comes up with his own lines, his own jokes.
Oh, there's some... I'm going to be going to bat a lot for this movie. There are some lines in this film that if I get an opportunity to say them, and I have had opportunities to use them in my real life, I'm going for it. I'm using some Live and Let Die lines.
Oh, no, I wrote down a few choice lines here and there, and I love the way he just mocks the henchmen from time to time, especially T.
There's old Albert. He's a crock. Got over careless with him some time back, and he took my whole arm off.
Well done, Albert.
Later on in the movie, I love these interactions with the villains and the way he just laughs at them. They're going to cut his fingers off, and he's still mocking them. I just love them.
Funny how the least little thing seems to amuse him as he throws his bent pistol into the garbage bin.
See, that's a great moment.
I'm sure we can lick you into shape, darling.
Going to be completely useless to you. Oh, sure, we'd be able to lick you into shape.
What was he called? Oh, God, lick you into shape, darling. I may or may not have used that one in the past. I will not reveal if it was successful or not. But no, Roger is just, and obviously, you know, it's 2017. We're just a few months after his passing, so it's very easy to get, you know, emotional and give him a pass, so to speak. I've always genuinely liked his Bond. He wasn't an obvious choice. He's not a tough guy. He's certainly different. He's very different from Sean. But funnily enough, this, when they approached him for Live and Let Die, was not the first time the producers approached him.
No, they approached him for Majesties too, from what I read. He's older than Sean Connery too. When I learned that, it shocked me. He looks like he's about 5 to 10 years younger than Sean Connery was when he quit the part.
I think that's because he does look so much older in the later films that when you go back to Live and Let Die, he looks so youthful. But yeah, the guy's like 44, 45 years old in Live and Let. He's not a spring chicken.
No.
But he looks it because, well, at some point in the future, we'll get to A View to a Kill, but he looks so old in that one.
He kept his youthful vitality as long as he could. In this one, it's staggering. He looks like a boy at times.
So as far as the looks go, you understand why they hired him as James Bond. But thankfully, he's not a bad actor either. I think he's pretty good in this.
It started with Diamonds and Are Forever, but it's more evident with Live and Let Die. The series is becoming more a parody of itself. For better or worse, it is.
Bond fans, that is, will sometimes use the term the Mankiewicz trilogy. Tom Mankiewicz, who wrote the Diamond script, the Live and Let Die script, and I think he had a... If he's not the sole creditor on Golden Gun, he certainly wrote the original draft of Golden Gun. I think Roger is delightful. It's weird. I know we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We want to stick to this movie. But funnily enough, I think his Live and Let Die Bond and his Spy Who Loved Me Bond are similar. I feel it's the Golden Gun Bond where they try to make... Oh, no, let's make him like Sean. Do you get that feeling from Live and Let Die? I don't. I saw it last night for the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th time in my life, maybe 12th time. I feel like I'm watching a Roger Bond.
Yes and no. There's not the one scene in The Man with the Golden Gun where it really feels like they're writing the story for Sean Connery and they're putting Roger Moore in it, and it's disturbing when he meets
Miss Anders.
Miss Anders.
I didn't recognize you with your clothes on. But that's before then, when he twists her arm.
When he twists her arm, that's a Sean Connery move. There's nothing like that at first glance. The sleeping with Solitaire, and it's a bit Roger Moore-esque, but
his Bond sleeps around a lot.
Oh no, he's covered in STDs from head to toe. There's something there that's more Sean Connery than Moore. I don't know. I'm trying to see, because violent, he's never violent towards her. He's never slaps her around.
He is, despite him having tricked her into sleeping with him. When they're in bed, we're in that scene, you know, after she's gone on blabbering about the high priestess, the prince of another world, and he's like, what the heck is going on?
You know, he has a moment that Connery has, he kind of goes, oh, I did this for my country kind of thing, when he's like getting dressed and he's going to go investigate, and it's like, okay, you stay there.
But
like,
there is that moment where he's like, well, she's not going to give me any information I need. I'm getting the hell out of here. There is that moment. Yeah, it's true. But you got to be Bond also. I mean, this is also one of the criticisms of the character, certainly in our day and age, where we try to be a little bit more sensitive about these things. That's a very Bondian thing to do. Well, this was fun. What information can you give me? Oh, nothing. Well, ta-ta. You know, yeah, he does get up and go. But I do like that little moment where, you know, Solitaire is very distraught. She was a virgin prior to this night, and we're led to believe that it is in part her virginity that provided her with this power to read the tarot cards and somewhat see into the future. And she's very distraught because she can't read the cards anymore. And, you know, Roger, I love Roger. He snuggles over and says, darling, try not to get too angry with me, but the cards were slightly stacked in my favor. You know, Sean wouldn't do that.
No.
Roger does that. So there's always a little bit of that balancing act. You know, it's like, I'm sorry. I kind of fooled you on that one, you know.
He admits it.
I still liked it, though, but I'm sorry.
The cards, did you notice the 007 on top of the cards?
I've heard of that. But I had to be told that. I will not deny the fact that I've certainly seen the movie a number of times before I was told it. Not that I discovered. I cannot claim to have
known. It's fairly noticeable. Because
but they're shown for, yeah, I mean, Matthew's showing me a still of the but is that zoomed in? There's no shot of the movie that looks
that's,
like that.
That's a still from the movie. You clearly see.
Really?
Yeah. And if you want to buy the prop replica, you're going to have to shelve at least $160 plus shipping for cards, tarot cards.
I think I'll start with that that old Casino Royale DVD that came with the two stacks of Casino Royale. I'll start with that's about $15-$20 at this point.
maybe even less. Let's get the cards. But yeah, honestly, if it was $10, I would have 12 packs by now.
Are you kidding me? I'd have a pack. Oh, I was about to say two. You beat me. No, forget it. I was going to say two, so I can like have one untouched, unsullied, and another one that I can show off.
And learn to look. And one thing I love looking for things like that. The espresso machine that he has at the beginning of the movie, it's a La Pavonie. And well, if you want one, do you want me to make you guess, or do you want me to just tell you how much it's worth?
Can you act the one he uses in the film? That is that still on the market today?
I think so. I don't know. It looks like it looks the same. Looks the same to me. Maybe a more.
You know what? I know those things can get kind of expensive, so I'm going to say $300.
Oh, God, you're so wrong. That barely covers shipping.
What do you mean that barely covers shipping?
Well, it's Canadian Amazon, so it might be different elsewhere, but it's the price that I found, $1,079. Shipping is $2.97.
Is it made of crystal? What is this thing?
I don't know why. There's 18 left in stock, so that could influence the price, but it's the same goddamn thing.
Holy smoke. They put it in a gold box. The price of the machine is preposterous, but I'm just as flabbergasted about the $300 for shipping? How big is this? It doesn't look that big. You see it in a movie.
It's probably
ridiculous.
They probably make like 20 per year.
Oh, professional espresso machine. I didn't read the title. That's why. It explains everything. Just make it a 00 espresso machine. Now you can charge $1,000 for it. That's okay. I have no problem with that.
Yeah. If it has a 007 logo, you're going to buy it. Also, yeah, I wrote down a few things here because we didn't talk about the way that Roger makes his initial appearance, the first time he appears on screen as James Bond. Like Sean Connery, they build up to it. You see his hands, and then the classic line, Bond, James Bond.
They build up to George.
Yeah, they did. They did.
He's in the car. You see his chin, that beautiful chin of his. He's smoking the cigarette in the car, and it's only once, I believe it's when he says, my name's Bond, James Bond, that you actually only see his face really for the first time. He's so happy as he says that. I love it every time.
Yeah, we'll discuss. But I have my own feelings.
Yeah, we got to
I can't wait, but there's a few more shows before that one. I love Roger. I love Sean. I even love George. But Roger, the way he's introduced, he's just there.
He's in bed with Miss Caruso from The Italian Job.
I know, but there is no build-up to it. Every other director that has directed the first appearance of a Bond actor, there's a build-up to it. And this one is just right there. It's like there's... Mm. And that's my main complaint.
It's almost like it's not his introduction. This is like his second or third movie.
Yeah. And that's my main complaint, my only complaint about this movie is the director. I'm not a fan of Guy Hamilton's effort and as James Bond. He made one good movie. Mind you, it's Goldfinger, so it's one of the best. Everything else that he's made is mediocre at best.
Yeah, and we also broached this a little bit before we hit record. I don't entirely disagree with you. I mean, the thing is, we're not talking Diamonds or Golden Gun today. We'll get to them. But it just so happens we're talking about the one other Hamilton film that I kind of like. You know, if this was Diamonds or Golden Gun, we'd maybe on the same page.
If I was going to rate them, I would put Goldfinger number one. I would actually agree with you. I'd put Live and Let Die number two.
I appreciate that.
I'm glad you are.
You know what? I will agree with you insofar as, again, I like it. I'll even say I like it a lot. I watched it last night. It was maybe a little bit late, and my weekend had been pretty exciting up until that point, so I was maybe a little tired. But it was one of the rare times where I felt the movie was teeny-weeny bit long.
Which part?
I think that boat chase can be trimmed a little bit. I think it can be trimmed. And you know what I noticed too?
Jesus Christ. That boat chase like lasts like almost 20 minutes. It's incredibly long too long.
Well, it's like, well, it's multiple boats. He actually changes boats once they, not when they crash the wedding, when the bad guys go into the swimming pool and he steals.
But
the
what
other
you
boat.
Don't know about Live and Let Die, and none of our listeners know, it's actually a spin-off, a prequel to The Dukes of Hazzard.
Sure.
The entire time I was watching it, like, wow, this really reminds me of those shows and Smoking the Bandit type of cars.
Fun movie, but I see where you're coming from. And probably one of, not just the fact that we're down in the southern United States, but there's a particular character that shows up. Now, Sheriff J.W. Pepper.
What's worse, the racism in the book or that character? Because you know that character today would be rejected by mass audiences. Worst thing is that they loved him so much, they brought him back for the sequel, well, the follow-up movie.
Yeah, that's a little bit weird. Funnily enough, I think J.W. Pepper, if he had showed up for one or two scenes, a couple funny lines, it would have been okay. But the film keeps cutting back to him.
You know what? That comes back to my main complaint about this movie. The director obviously loved that actor. He loved them.
He's given it. You know, it's one of those things. The actor's just doing what he read on the page and what the director's saying. That's good cut print. He's just doing his job. The actor's name escapes me. Clifton James.
He almost plays the same part in Superman 2.
I have to rewatch Superman 2. It's been a while.
Like three Kryptonians just show up in Houston, Texas, and they're
isn't he one of the generals or something like that?
He's not actually. He's the cop. They first meet a couple of cops, and he's like the sheriff of the town. I might be mistaken, but I'm 99% sure it's him.
Well, see, that's where, again, you're wrong again about Live and Let Die. He's so good at playing that role that they brought him back, not just for another Bond film. No. They brought him back to play some character in a Superman movie. I'm not going to lie, I do get a kick out of at the end of this boat chase. It's not a bad chase, but it is too long. And
it's overindulgent.
That's actually a very good way of describing it. And, you know, he's, aren't you some kind of doomsday machine boy? And then one of his colleagues pulls him over. You know, this boy's from London and he's working with our boys.
It's a little bit funny. Like, there's
secret agent on whose side? Like, that makes me laugh. But he is in the movie too much.
He was not good enough to bring back, especially in the sequel where it makes no sense.
In a country like, we just saw him take the greatest pleasure in arresting black people. What is he doing in Thailand?
How can he afford on his salary to go to Thailand?
No idea.
Was he paid by the British to shut up and we're going to pay for the vacation?
I'll tell you another thing. I'm being hypocritical here because I keep saying I like the movie a lot. But another thing that I find a little weird is the whole Mr. Big is, or actually the other way around, Dr. Kananga is Mr. Big. Like, why aren't those two different characters? Like, what is the deal there? Does that plot not work if they're actually two different characters?
I don't understand that part. I was rewatching it. I'm like, yeah, you don't get a good look at Mr. Big, but when you do, it's clearly visible.
You have an excellent note when you went for a pee-pee break or something. I read your notes. He looks like a burnt victim or something.
Yes,
like that.
Yes, he does.
It's pretty terrible makeup. I'm shocked.
It's embarrassing.
That being said, we showered Roger with some praise. I like him a lot. I got to say, whether it's in this movie or in any other ones he shows up, I've always been a big Yaphet Kotto fan.
I love them.
He's great.
He's good.
As Kananga.
It's weird that there hasn't been a black James Bond villain since him. Like, yeah, the lead villain, there's never been. There's a lot. Especially right now, like you mentioned.
They should make more movies where black people are the bad guys.
not black people, but
I see what you mean.
Villains of various ethnicities.
Yeah.
I mean, the last time Bond faced off against a villain of anything but white, Gustav Graves is actually Colin Moon.
That's like the best and worst example at the same time. But Yaphet Kotto is great. And I do feel as though, and I think what helped is the fact that I watched the movie last night and I finished reading the book Tuesday or Wednesday night, something like that. And yesterday was Saturday. I find that Yaphet Kotto, although he doesn't have the stature of the Mr. Big from the book, I do find he's behaving. Like, he's very well spoken. He's very calm, organized. Very calm, very self-assured, but not in a provocative way. It's not exactly the same character, but I do feel like they did try to inject sort of that quiet genius, that quiet confidence into the character. He's not maniacal, really.
You know, in my research, I was trying to find, because he's not the character of the book, obviously. And I Googled something to see if there were other drug dealers in the 60s, 70s, and there's Frank Lucas. It doesn't, the timeline doesn't fit for him to be the main inspiration, but he was a drug dealer. They made a movie with Denzel Washington, the American Gangster.
Oh, that's that guy. Okay.
And I was like, maybe it's him, but I'm like, no, that doesn't fit. And
a little bit later, no? Yeah, or maybe actually, at the same time?
Around the same time. So maybe he might have made the news somehow. But you know who I'm certain is the main inspiration was Papa Doc.
Oh, that's a dictator.
That's actually
on IT.
Haitian dictator. Yeah. And he was actually a doctor. So it's obvious that, and people compare him to Baron Samedi, so it's almost like he was actually the real-life Mr. Big. So I think he might have been the main inspiration. I mean, and Tom McGuinness has passed away. We can't ask him those questions.
Bless his heart.
Pretty sure that's what they were going for. I mean,
could be. I mean, they can't put all the bits of information into these behind-the-scenes books. And I've read a few, but I've never read that, but
that's my theory. I mean,
but it's not a bad theory. I kind of agree with it, actually. It's probably not that difficult to imagine either. You know, Dr. Kananda, small Caribbean island. Like, it does kind of fit.
It does kind of fit.
So Yaphet Kotto, alien across 110th Street. I mean, just a great actor, but he is a really cool villain. I like how he seems to appreciate Bond guessing what his plan is. Like, oh, I'm sure you just give it away for free on the streets. Exactly, Mr. Bond.
Yes.
Exactly. It'll drive them positively out of the minds. Like, he's really enjoying that. You're right, Bond. That's exactly what I'm going to do. You're almost as smart as me.
Yeah, that's the thing. He acknowledges Bond's abilities, and he's like, oh, there you good boy, good boy.
Absolutely. His dialogue is very good, too. The question still stands. To the gentleman concerned, I would expect Solitaire to be no less the lady. Like, he speaks really cool way. I do like him a lot. We get some other pretty awesome...
I love the henchmen. All the henchmen are amazing.
They're pretty freaking awesome.
I need to show you Jeffrey Holder, the guy, the actor who plays...
He's a professional dancer. Made most of his career through dancing. I think that was his first love.
Marvelous. Absolutely marvelous. Just try making something like that out of a cooler nut. Why, it's even prettier than a cooler. Nuttier than a cooler, actually.
See, yeah, great laugh again.
So good.
Do you know that he made he made a series of commercials.
I had seen a few of them. There's a YouTube channel. I think it's called No Small Parts. And it's this guy. He does these 10 to 15 minute mini documentaries on the lives of artists and actors who you know them, but you don't really know them. And he did one on
Jeffrey Holder.
And that's where I've sort of learned that, okay, this guy's not really an actor. He's a dancer and actor. But they did talk a bit about the Sprite commercials. That scene where Bond and Solitaire, they've slept together now. It's the next morning that they pass through a little graveyard.
And he's playing my the flute. God.
You know, it's going to be a beautiful day. Beautiful day. Then they walk away. Scott continues playing the flute. And there's a little microphone in the flute. They are heading for the hill.
They're heading for the hill.
There is one other character. Oh, I'm sure tons of characters, and you can add some more, but the one, we don't see him too much, but I get a kick every time he shows up. Hey, Jim, what's shaking, baby? Relax, the cab driver. Oh, my God.
I hope you would mention him. He's awesome.
For an extra $20, I'll drive you straight to a Ku Klux Klan cookout, and Bond's giving him the eye like, what is this Joker doing here? He heading on in. God, I love that. He's not a character. He's a caricature, in fairness. But holy smokes.
Brings a fun energy. Oh, he's great.
We've gone through Bond. We've gone through the litany of antagonists in this film. We haven't talked about the Bond girl.
Yeah. Well, she was 22. Introducing Jane Seymour.
I'm having trouble here because what you point out is fair. It's mathematical. She could only be 21 or 22. I was watching the film last night, as I already said, and I was reminded, you know, and I'm in my early 30s. I'm not like a spring chicken anymore.
Even to this day, Jane Seymour, she's a beautiful, beautiful, mature woman, but she's just as beautiful.
Call
today.
The doctor. Dr. Quinn Medicine. She's Dr. Quinn Medicine. Call her up. I'm feeling sick. Get the doctor. No, she's a beautiful. She's a very good actress. I don't know if she's very good in this. I think she's doing what the script is asking of her. She's maybe even a little bit, because in the book we get that background on her, so we sort of understand her, but we don't get that background.
She's really a worse character in the movie. I'm sorry.
Well, didn't we just spend 20 minutes blasting Sage? Is this J.W. Peppa? You can't call her the worst character in the world. J.W. Peppa's the worst character.
No, I said she's worse. Or the version that she from the novel is better than the version in the movie.
Yeah, maybe not by leaps and bounds, but she feels a little bit more complete in the book.
Yes.
Whereas here, she really is just the damsel in distress.
She's a prop. She's literally a prop that they bring from one location to the other. She becomes a MacGuffin near the end of the movie. She's a thing that Bond has to save, but she is close to what's the name of a character in A View to a Kill?
Oh, Stacey Sutton.
She's close to her. She's probably the least annoying of the most annoying.
One of the things, she feels incomplete. Not only in the book do we get the backstory, but because the voodooism is so much more prominent in the book, once she's taken away from Mr. Big, or taken back, this and that, it seems to be a bigger threat to Mr. Big in the book because he needs that aura, that image of I'm the voodoo master and here is my mind reader. In the book, that never really comes into play. Like, he's angry that she betrayed him, but, you know, whatever.
He's angry because
he gives her a good slap. You know, I would have given you love if you'd asked me to, but, or when the time came, or whatever the line is, but that's pretty much it. You know?
Yeah.
He'll kill her. It's fine. Again, Jane Seymour was and still is, an astonishingly, I mean, really, like, shockingly good-looking, both young and old. It's weird. It's one of those performances where I find when she's still being held by Kananga's grip, she's more interesting. Like the first time she meets Bond underneath the filet of soul, I know who you are, why you've come, and where you. I don't know what the other thing is. And Bond is like, isn't it a little presumptuous? And given we've only just met, you know, they do have almost a more interesting repartee when she's being the High Priestess Solitaire, as opposed to when she's liberated. She's actually more boring when she's liberated.
She feels like a child when she's liberated. It's really, because she's so young, and even Roger Moore, about 20 years older than her,
which makes that bedroom scene a little bit weird.
It's a bit creepy. Like, he looks young, but he doesn't look like he's the same age as she is.
Although there's a darn good line in that one, too. You know, lover's lesson number one and lover's lesson number two. Is the time before we go for lesson number three? And she, well, of course, there's no sense in going out half-cocked. That's, I don't know. Again, I will keep on delivering these lines until we're done recording.
No, Roger Moore, top form here. The direction and the script failed this movie.
Speaking of let's talk a little bit about the script and more specifically the villain's plot. We talked about the villain and how much we like him and the actor playing him. We haven't really talked about his plot. Now, we give a lot of love to the Bloody Morgan plot of the book. What about this one here in the film?
It's the same as any drug dealer. Get the first stasis free. After you gotta pay.
It's a little underwhelming.
It's really underwhelming.
It doesn't feel very befitting of a Bond film. Even Sanchez in License to Kill, he's going after Sanchez because of some very personal things.
And
that
also,
Sanchez's
operation is more complex.
There's the whole missile rockets or whatever they are. Whereas Kananga, it really is just overtaking the heroin market. That's pretty much it.
And his lair,
which is very evil.
His lair is like Kmart lair.
Can I say kind of like it? I like the fact that it's underneath the voodoo ceremony ground.
Come on. You had the...
Oh, is this from the World of James Bond book?
Yeah.
I have that book, but I
You have...
He's got his own monorail.
Come on.
He's got his own monorail.
Blofeld had a monorail inside a volcano. This guy has a shack in underground.
It's not a shack. It's a... You got a shark pool.
A shark pool.
You have a little
office space.
Office space where you can have champagne. He offers Bond and solitaire. He offers Bond and solitaire. She betrayed him. He gives him some champagne. Her some champagne. Have these missile silo thingies that they use to transport the cocaine, the heroin in.
Yeah,
it's all located above this, which we haven't talked about. This crazy voodoo ground where they have these sacrifices. Mm-hmm. That's actually where one of the MI6 agents dies at the start. It's not the. It's not the best enemy lair, but I kind of like it. I kind of like it.
You know what it reminded me of? I haven't seen that movie in decades now, but do you remember in the 1990s movie adaptation of The Phantom with Billy Zane?
Ooh, I think...
It's an obscure reference. I'm probably the only person who remembers.
I know what you're talking about, but I don't have many memories
of it. Well, the end of that movie, the villains have a similar lair where they have a shark pool. But that shark pool is a river, and it's about as wide as your... If you spread your arms, this is as... Like, it's incredibly small. I'm like, okay, you know that the shark is probably going to die. He can't turn around. He's just going to... You're going to kill a shark. It's
animal cruelty.
It's really cruel.
See, that's where Dr. Kananga is superior. It's a calm pool. They're regularly fed.
But that's their version of the book's version of the boat thing. He just ties them up together and dop.
For a moment there, when you said there's the equivalent of the film, I had no idea what you were talking about, but that's what you're talking about.
It's only when I rewatch it, having read the books recently, I'm like, oh my God, it is in the film, but it's really... The problem, like I'm going to say it, it's a lack of funds. I mean, they did that scene, not even 10 years later, they did that exact scene in For Your Eyes Only. Yep. So,
and that's an awesome scene.
It's a great scene. I mean, there is prudence to how these movies are made after Honor Majesty's Secret Service. They were going always bigger, bigger, bigger. And when Majesty didn't perform, they went lower and they stayed around $7 million for... couple of years, and it shows. This movie, at times, and they changed the ratio. I don't know if you noticed that.
I did.
That
it says a 1.85 instead of 2.35. Yeah, I think. Yeah,
it hurts the film. Those films are made for bigger screens, and all the Mankiewicz trilogy, as you mentioned, they're all shot on that same ratio, and it hurts the film.
Yeah, it is a little bit weird. Not that you can't make nice looking movies in 1.85, but it's true that the 2.35 really, there's something particularly cinematic.
Yeah.
It's that widescreen panning that you can do that is very impressive, especially in those, I have to stop talking about Majesties, but those Piz Gloria, the Swiss Alps, I mean, come on. Shut up.
We'll get there when we get there.
Now, sharks are not the only animal threat to James Bond in this film. What do you think of Trespassers Will Be Eaten, which is there was actually a real Kananga personality behind that sequence. But in the film, there's this little sequence where he's brought to the farm, take Bond to the farm, which is kind of like take Bond to school. So Teehee was this one of the many, we haven't mentioned him yet, but he has these glasses, very tall guy, kind of like Jeffrey Holder, but maybe not as imposing. He has this like hook hand. And they bring him to an alligator farm, where they're also preparing the heroin, for that matter. And there's a scene where they leave Bond on a little rock island in the middle of this pond lake. I think that's what they call them. And the alligators come to eat him. What do you think of that sequence? I think it's kind of fun.
It's the beginning of the boat chase, in a way. The watch has a magnet, but at first it fails, and he has to use his wits to get out, and... Well,
and his balls.
And his balls. But it's a cool stunt. It's a very cartoon-like stunt. He steps on the crocodiles to escape. Are they crocodiles or alligators?
You can always tell an alligator by its round snout.
Okay, I didn't pay attention. I'll call them crocodile. So he steps on them to escape. It's a cool stunt. It's done for real. And I love when they do stunts for real. But when you think about it, he didn't use his wits. It just... step on them.
I think it takes a little bit of wit to.
It takes
balls. There's wit as far as cunning, and then there's like courage.
Yeah, no, it's courage. But I wish he came up with a clever solution. But there was.
There's not a whole lot you got. I think that they sort of wrote themselves into a corner with that scene where there's not going to be anything terribly sophisticated. It's just going to be something like, oh my goodness, I can't believe he just dashed on the snouts of like five or six alligators or crocodiles. We're not sure. Probably alligator, crocodile, all in a row in sequential order. But no, it's a super ballsy stunt. I get what you're saying, and it's a fair point taken. It doesn't, personally, doesn't detract from that sequence. I like it a lot.
It's still impressive.
Another great line, just before Teehee leaves him, he explains how old Albert there took my whole arm off. Well done, Albert.
Yeah.
Just, again, this is nonstop. One that nonstop.
Today they wouldn't have accepted that animal activists would have been up in arms because, he steps on crocodiles, blah, blah, blah. Which is a fair point to me.
I don't know how sensitive, and now I myself I am a great admirer of the animal kingdom. I'm such an admirer of the animal kingdom. I don't understand the concept of zoos. Why don't we just leave them in the jungle and don't get near them? But anyway, that's just me. I don't know how sensitive animal activists are. Like if they film that, they're croc. They have strong snouts. Does that hurt them? I'm not a crocodile or an alligator. I don't know if that hurts them.
They don't look happy. I don't think I don't think that's right. But anyway, they still did it. It's a cool moment. It's a little bit weird. I don't think people would.
Things with animals these days, very very careful. Also, the CG Komodo dragon in Skyfall. Yeah. Like they were never going to use a real dragon. It was going to be a CG creature. So.
I'm just going to say it. Roger Moore is James Bond for kids most of the time. Whether it's right for
sleeping
there to
with
be...
that many women, sleeping with that many women, is he? Is he
kids don't get the thing that kids are going to gravitate towards to, and what adults are going to notice are two different things. You can show a kid movie to an adult, and a kid movie to a kid. They're not the same thing. Are going to grab their attention. I recently watched Coco, and many adults came out of that movie crying because the subject of the movie being with family and death. And not being forgotten, it touched a lot of people's heart. But kids didn't, because of their...
It's a colorful cartoon for them.
Just colorful cartoons, action, fun, great time. But adults were like, it was an emotional movie. Even I, at times...
There were some sniffles in the audience.
I had once... So I think kids... As a kid, I loved Roger Moore. As a teenager, eventually I disowned Roger Moore. I'm going to be honest. There's a part of me where I was like, oh, it doesn't work. Like, especially in the 90s with Pierce Brosnan. It's like, oh, it's the perfect James Bond. It's Sean Connery and Roger Moore mixed together. That's how you do Bond. That's right. That's right. And as a kid, I must admit I preferred Roger Moore because his adventures were more extravagant. Mm. His stunts were more cartoonish. Everything was bit more cartoonish. And so is that stunt. The crocodile stunt is a cartoon.
It is.
Bugs Bunny would do the same thing. And I'm like, okay, that's correct.
I think it's a very sophisticated point about the fact that children will recognize, they will be entertained and enthralled for different reasons than the adults. But maybe that's why I love Roger so much. When I was younger, the weird parts of the movies entertained me, and still do to large degrees. And now when I'm an adult, I get other things out of it. So I still love Roger, but maybe for slightly different reasons. We have a Felix Leiter, one of many.
I was shocked to see him. I don't know if you were... I knew he was in this movie, but I've seen License to Kill more often than.
Well, you're a Timmy guy.
Yeah, I'm a Tim guy. But I was shocked how young he looked, and that was I love their repartee.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah. It sucks that he's not in the movie more, and that there's never been like an action movie with James Bond and Felix Leiter back to back like fighting bad guys. They've never done it in any movies.
Which is, well, I guess maybe it's weird because they never seem to be able to settle on a Felix Leiter. So the audience but even if you're a diehard like you or me, like the joke about Felix Leiter is that it's never the same guy. So we like Felix Leiter because of the weird reasons. You know, Tom, Dick, and Jane, it's like, who's Felix Leiter? Yeah. And, oh, he's been in like 15 movies? I don't remember him. You don't remember him because it's never the same guy, you know. But it would be kind of cool if they... hey, you got to bring back Jeffrey Wright. Bond 25, bring back Jeffrey. We want Jeffrey. I vote for him. But I agree. David Hedison, the actor who plays Felix here, is very, very good, very entertaining, very charming. He kind of is. The Leiter of the Felix of the book is like blonde and from Texas. and I don't know where David Hedison is from, and he's certainly not blonde, but personality-wise,
I think he's from New Jersey, I think.
He kind of feels like the Felix Leiter from the book.
And he does.
Yeah, he's very... Yeah, you know, Bond blows stuff up left and right, but he's not too angry about it. Yeah, he's a good guy, Bond.
He's having a good time.
He seems to be having a good time, despite it all.
He's
yeah.
not dark or as intense as Jeffrey Wright. Jeffrey Wright just looks angry all the time.
Well, certainly in Quantum of Solace. I do... Again, he's given a good performance there, but his Felix from Casino... God.
Yes.
Friend, give me one of those. Hold the fruit.
I'm your brother from Lang Lake.
I feel there is one thing... we should talk about, and I think I saw it in your notes somewhere. Thank goodness you come with notes, Matthew. It's the first Bond film not scored by John Barry. Well, actually, you know what? I'm wrong. Monty Norman did heavy work on the doc. No, that's another bonus podcast.
He was not involved at all.
Right. Which makes it exciting because it's a fresh take. On
it's very groovy. It's noticeable.
Yeah, hell yeah, it's noticeable. And again, sort of like how we sort of started this episode by saying this is kind of like the Blaxploitation Bond. It's kind of the Blaxploitation Bond score as well. So obviously, it's a time capsule. They're never going to use that music in any of the other films, nor would they have used it before necessarily. I'm not going to lie. That is one of my favorite Bond scores.
It's the fifth Beatle that did it.
The fifth genius, as I would describe him. I mean, it's so cool. George Martin.
I love his score. Sometimes it's a little bit too noticeable. It's a little bit too, like, groovy. But at the same time, the negative are outweighed by the positive. Because it's a great... it fits with the song. It just creates a musical environment, universe.
You talk of a musical universe. I don't know if you did that intentionally. The Live and Let Die song... appears in the universe.
Yes, I wrote it in my notes. It's actually
that's good. I like that, and I've heard through other podcasting brethren of ours that the singer, unfortunately, her name escapes me, but the singer in that scene in the Louisiana, in the New Orleans Filet of Soul, she was going to, that was going to be her version in the title sequence. Of course, they got Paul McCartney of all people. And God bless Paul McCartney. I love Live and Die, his song. But man, that singer in the Filet of Soul, she freaking belts out Live and Let Die.
I have to admit, my favorite rendition of that song was by Guns N' Roses.
Their rendition is awesome. I should learn to talk into the mic. I'm going to stop turning these pages. I don't know where I thought. I could have sworn it was in your nose, but anyways. I like that rendition a lot. It's a really... kick-ass rendition. It's like, well, it's not heavy metal. It's like the hard rock.
No, it's a air metal version.
Air metal version. There you go. But I think because it's a very different version, which is good. You know, you want to reinvent certain things when you're going to cover something. But the version at that Filet of Soul, and she, like, she's looking at Bonsai Live and Let Die, and she's almost pointing at him, mm-hmm. and he's like, "What's going on? Why are you so intent on looking at me?" Whoop.
And that's a part that's also in the novel when he's there at the club, and the same thing happens to Felix and James Bond. They get sucked in the bowels of a club.
Why don't you like a booth? I had a bad turn in one once. Again, I'm just going to keep on coming out with these. So the score, very good score. What do you think of the James Bond theme? I think it starts kicking in when. The taxi cab driver, Ku Klux Klan Cookout, is driving him into Harlem, uptown. That's where, like, this Live and Let Die version of the Bond theme kicks in. It's pretty cool.
That's also the gun barrel sequence.
Yes, that's true. The same music does play in the gun barrel sequence.
Paul, he turns...
That's another bonus episode, but why not?
He turns, he shows the camera... it's the ratio. I much prefer the version he does for The Spy Who Loved Me, where it's wider and he's wearing a tux. I love my James Bond wearing a tux, looking proper. The only ones who haven't worn a tux are Sean.
I
think
George, I guess.
Isn't he wearing a tux?
Would he wear a tux? Would he wear a tux with a top hat? No, it's not a top hat, but whatever.
I think it's a tux. I'm not going to be sure, so we'll say no. So, Sean, George, don't wear the tux. Roger, Pierce, Timothy Dalton, all wore tux. But Daniel Craig is just wearing a suit. And the way he walks, I hate his gun barrel. He just looks like a grumpy old man.
He is a grumpy old man.
He doesn't want those goddamn suits that he wears are so tight. He probably can't even turn properly. Probably has a stunt coat.
Should do a bonus episode on some articles from the Suits of Bond.
Yeah.
He does comment on that. I've read one of our articles where it says, like, the Suits Inspector look really nice, but they don't fit him, you know?
No, they
which is a fair point. It's a fair, they look too tight, Inspector.
It's ridiculous. I mean, those two, as much as some of the suits that Timothy Dalton look baggy, they went the other way with Daniel Craig. He looks like he's wearing somebody's...
I think I just discovered a real... bonus episode, not we should probably do a bonus episode on what Bond wears,
of course,
and just our likes and dislikes, because I'm not a clothing connoisseur. Back to the Live and Let Die. What are we talking about today? Live and Let Die, the movie.
Yeah, we need to wrap this up.
Wrap this baby up. So, I mean, I think we hit most of the points. Bond, the villains, the girl, the locations.
We need to mention this.
Yes, go ahead.
Solitaire. At some times, she looks like Queen Amidala from the prequels.
Yes.
I know I mentioned it to you, but I had to say it. So it's on.
But we need the listeners to understand this as well.
Yeah.
So every time all those fanboys go back and watch The Phantom Menace for the 200th time, they get to think about a Bond film instead. A much better film. Mm-hmm. Despite any reservations you and I might have about this movie, better movie. Live and Let Die.
More coherent and better acted.
Yeah. Oh, I'm telling you, that better acted. Better dialogue.
Oh, my God.
You know what I noticed? The scene where... We haven't talked about Rosie Carver, although she doesn't play a huge role, but the scene where Rosie Carver and Bond are in their little hotel room, and she goes, I'm going to change in the bathroom or whatnot. She screams, there's a snake. Oh, I forgot to tell you, never go in there without a mongoose. What happens at the start of Casino Royale in Madagascar?
A mongoose
and a snake fight. Mm. But yeah, maybe we should start thinking about wrapping things up a little bit.
So final thoughts?
Great minds think alike. Again, I like it quite a bit. I've agreed on some of the negatives with you. Yes, last night was unfortunately the first time where I thought the film was a little long. I'm going to blame the fact that I was fatigued, not the film. But it's not perfect. It's not my favorite Roger. We'll rank them at some point in the future, but I do enjoy it very, very much.
Yeah, I think I have similar feeling. It's a good movie to a point.
Where can we be found online? Edgar, can be found at on Twitter at @OH_pop, @OOPOP. Matthew.
Matt O'Clara.
We have the official podcast Twitter account at The James Bond Complex. I've got a Facebook page, The James Bond Complex / I don't know. You use Facebook more than me. Facebook / Bond Complex.
Just type down James Bond Complex.
We've got an email
account. Go to JamesBondComplex.com.
And as I believe we've been saying for a few episodes, we are working on a website. The fingers are crossed as I'm saying this. When this is going to be released at some point in the future, there shall be the www.
It should already be there. If we did our job, it's already there.
As you are listening to this, there is a triple W.
We're in the past, you're in the future right now.
Right, exactly. So that's all for us on this episode. But do not worry, because James Bond will return in Moonraker.
No. We're doing something special. We're doing a bonus episode.
Good Lord.
Have you forgotten about the comic books?
Comic books? James Bond comic books?
Yes.
Yes, I read one this morning, actually. James Bond will return in Varger? 2015/2016, yeah. I guess. Tata, merci, à la prochaine.
À plus tard.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.